to claim money that's rightfully his, and it doesn't seem fair to turn him away just because he messed up on some minor clerical procedure.
True, said the judge. Well, all right. Go ahead.
One more thing, Your Honor, said Joe. I would like to add for the record that I am doing this on a pro bono basis.
Good of you, said the judge.
Forgoing my normal legal fee of $4,200.
In the laughter that followed, Joe turned toward Mandy and me and winked. The hearing went into recess while Joe wrote Mr. Russell's claim against him. When he was finished, Mr. Russell's $4,200 was added back onto the total, and Joe took the stand. He told the court that he had written the checks in the expectation that the developers of City Market, where Sweet Georgia Brown's was located, would come through with several $1,000 they owed him, but they had not. Therefore, the checks were unintentional overdrafts. The judge and the prosecutor appeared to doubt Joe's explanation, but they agreed to drop the charges if he made good on the entire $18,000 in 1 month's time. Failing that, he would almost certainly be indicted. The judge, the prosecutor, and the plaintiffs all expressed the hope that Joe would settle the matter before it came to that. And he did. But it wasn't through the cash flow of Sweet Georgia Brown's. Joe was saved this time by a loan of $18,000 from a rich young couple who had recently moved to Savannah and had fallen under the spell of Joe Odom and Sweet Georgia Brown's. Joe's good luck extended to the matter of finding new quarters to live in before John Thorson returned. At the last moment, he had arranged to occupy the spacious and elegant parlor floor of the Hamilton Turner House, a few blocks away on Lafayette Square. The landlord was an old friend who lived in Natchez and knew all about Joe's bus tours and the tourist lunches and Joe's entourage and Jerry the hairdresser. All of that was fine with him. Joe finished his sweep of the Pulaski Square house, removing the last traces of his occupancy. Then he came back outside to sit on the front steps and have a cigarette. He had to admit things were not so bad after all. His bad checks had been made good. He was about to move into a beautiful old mansion. The prosecutor was off his back, and there was nothing for him to do now but smoke his cigarette and wait for Mandy to do one final load of laundry. When she was finished, he would disconnect the electricity and the telephone, turn off the water, lock the front door, and move on. It was daybreak when Joe went to bed in his new house. He slept until early evening. Then he rose and went to Sweet Georgia Brown's, where the first person through the door was Mr. Russell, the antiques dealer from Charleston. He was carrying the sconces, ornate brass fixtures with tall hurricane lamps. Joe put them up on either side of the big mirror over the bar and lit the candles. The light danced and flickered. "Will you take a check for them?" he asked.
"Why, certainly," said Mr. Russell. "I'd be much obliged," said Joe, "if you'd, hold on to it until the first of the month."
"I'd be happy to," Mr. Russell said.
Joe turned to go back to the piano and found himself looking into the grinning face of the real estate agent, John Thorson.
"I'm back," Mr. Thorson proclaimed. "If you still want that house on Pulaski Square, you can have it. I saved it for you the whole time I was gone."
"I know you did," said Joe, "and I appreciate it more than I can say."
Chapter 14. The Party of the Year. Engraved invitations to Jim Williams's black tie Christmas party began arriving in the mailboxes of Savannah's better homes the first week in December. They were received with surprise and consternation, for it had been assumed that, under the circumstances, Williams wouldn't be giving any party at all this year. Faced with the invitations, Savannah's social set grappled with the realization that the crowning social event of the winter season was going to take place at the scene of a notorious shooting, and that barely a month later the host would go on trial for murder. What to do? Savannah was a place of manners and decorum, first and foremost. It had been the birthplace, after all, of Ward McAllister, that self-appointed social arbiter of late 19th century America. It was Ward McAllister who had compiled the list of New York's elite 400 in 1892. This son of Savannah had codified the rules of conduct for ladies and gentlemen. The lively debate already raging over Williams's guilt or innocence shifted focus, moving to the question of whether it was proper for him to give his Christmas party, and whether, since he was indeed going to give it, it was proper to attend. This year, instead of asking, "Have you been invited?" people wanted to know, "Are you going to accept?" Millicent Moreland had counseled Williams not to give his party. "It wouldn't be the thing to do, Jim," she told him, and she thought she had talked him out of it, until her invitation arrived. For Mrs. Moreland, the party posed an agonizing dilemma. After many sleepless nights, she decided not to go. Williams refused to acknowledge that his party might be a manifestation of poor taste. He and his lawyers, he said, had decided that not to have the party would be an admission of guilt. Therefore, he was going to have it. He would, however, skip the all-male party the night after.
"The only person who's really going to miss that one," Williams said, "will be Leopold Adler. He won't be able to get out his binoculars and spy on it."
Williams was convinced that Lee Adler had prodded the district attorney into charging him with murder instead of a lesser crime, while outwardly pretending to be concerned for him. 2 days after the shooting, Emma Adler had written Williams a note expressing her sorrow and offering to help him in any way possible. She had signed the note, "Fondly, Emma."
"The use of the word fondly," said Williams, "proves the letter was an exercise in insincerity. Emma Adler is no more fond of me than I am of her, and we both know it."
Williams did not invite the Adlers to this year's party. As in years past, Williams set about making elaborate preparations well in advance. His assistants went out and gathered 3 truckloads of fresh palmetto fronds, cedar boughs, and magnolia leaves, and spent a full week decorating the 7 fireplaces and 6 chandeliers in Mercer House. On the day of the party, Lucille Wright arrived with roasts of ham, turkey, and beef, gallons of shrimp and oysters, tureens of dips and sauces, and quantities of cakes, brownies, and pies. She arranged the bountiful repast on silver platters and placed them around a mound of pink and white camellias in the center of the dining room table. A 60-foot garland of flame-throated orchids hung in swags along the spiral stairway. The scent of cedar and pine accented the air. At 7 o'clock sharp, Williams opened the front door of Mercer House and stood with his mother and his sister, Dorothy Kingery, to receive his guests. The 2 women wore evening gowns. Williams had on black tie and dinner jacket, with Russian Imperial Fabergé cufflinks gleaming in the cuffs of his dress shirt. He took a deep breath.
"Now I'll find out who my real friends are."
He didn't have long to wait. The first arrivals were already coming up the walk. And they kept coming. Dozens, scores, over 100. Each greeted Williams with warm expressions of support and then left their coats with an attendant in the study. If the mood was subdued at first, It picked up quickly as more and more guests arrived. White-jacketed butlers circulated with trays of drinks and hors d'oeuvres. "Pour with a heavy hand," Williams had told the bartender. Soon, the laughter and hilarity rose to such a pitch it drowned out the cocktail pianist at the grand piano. Williams had invited 200 people and set a goal for himself of 150 acceptances. It was clear that he had made his goal. In his own mind, at least, he had won a plebiscite of the social set. After an hour, he left his post in the receiving line and mingled with his guests. "What sort of people have come?" I asked him. "And what sort have stayed away?" "The holier-than-thou set has stayed home," he said. "The ones who have always been jealous of my success in Savannah and who want to let me know they disapprove. In addition to them, some of the people who honestly wish me well but are afraid to admit it publicly have also stayed home. The people you see here tonight are the ones who are secure enough to ignore anyone who might question their decision to come. Like that lady over there, Alice Dowling. Her late husband was the U.S. ambassador to Germany and Korea. She's talking with Malcolm McLean, the former mayor of Savannah and head of one of Savannah's leading law firms. The little old lady immediately to McLean's right is one of the seven women who founded the historic Savannah Foundation, Jane Wright. She's descended from the third royal governor of Georgia. Now, to her right, you see a distinguished-looking man with a white mustache. He's Bob Minus, one of the most brilliant and influential financiers in Savannah. His great-great-grandfather was the first white man born in the state. He's Jewish, a blue-blood Georgia Jew, the only Jew in the Oglethorpe Club. To his right, the two men talking in the doorway are George Patterson, the retired president of the Liberty National Bank, and Alexander Yearley, the former chairman of Robinson Humphrey, the big Atlanta investment bankers. Williams had the look of a poker player holding four aces. "Now, over there by the piano," he went on, "the lady in the bright red dress and the contralto voice. She's Vera Dutton Strong, talking non-stop, as usual. She's the heiress to the Dutton Pulpwood fortune, and she lives in a giant palace in Audley Park. It's fit for an embassy. Vera raises champion poodles. She's got about a dozen, and at least seven of them sleep right in the bedroom with her and her husband, Cahill. Vera's audience, at the moment, happens to be the director of the Telfair Museum, Alexander Gaudieri, which is a blessing, because she won't give him a chance to get a word in, and nobody wants to hear what he has to say anyway." As we walked past Vera Strong and the museum director, we caught a snippet of their conversation. "The bloodlines on both sides are magnificent," Mrs. Strong was saying. "You should see the way she carries herself. She has an even temperament and bright eyes. She's very intelligent."
"Not another dog," Williams cut in.
"Who said anything about a dog?"
Mrs. Strong replied.
"Now don't be coy, Vera," said Williams. "Magnificent bloodlines, even temperament. No one begrudges you another poodle. Come, come, fess up."
Vera Strong suddenly gasped.
"My God, how embarrassing. I was talking about Peter's fiancée. I'm going to be a mother-in-law."
She threw her head back and laughed. Then she clutched Williams by the arm. "You must swear you'll never tell anybody what I just said." Having sworn Williams to secrecy, she turned to the couple standing next to her.
"Did you hear that? Jim overheard me talking about Peter's fiancée, and it's simply too mortifying. I was saying..."
Williams turned aside.
"Well, that's Vera Strong. One of her many saving graces is her sense of humor." "Now those two," he said, nodding toward a handsome middle-aged man and woman, "are Roger and Claire Moultrie. He was president of the Savannah Gas Company until about 15 years ago, when they got involved in a bit of a scandal. One night, they drove out to a secluded spot along the river and parked their car. A night watchman came by and told them to leave because they were trespassing on the grounds of some shipyard or other. They refused to budge. The watchman called the cops. A cop came and demanded identification.
Roger became belligerent and scuffled with the policeman. At that point, Claire grabbed a pistol out of the glove compartment and shouted, "Duck, Roger, I'll kill the son of a bitch." The cop dragged her out of the car and pummeled her so badly she spent a week in the hospital. Both were charged with trespassing, drunkenness, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest. She was threatening the life of a policeman. He was striking a police officer. Roger refused the judge's suggestion that he pay a small fine and be done with it, so they went to trial. At the trial, Roger said they had driven to the moonlit spot to inspect the installation of gas lines, and that therefore, in so many words, they had been on company business. The most respected citizens of Savannah lined up to serve as character witnesses, and the jury delivered its verdict in 25 minutes, innocent of all charges. Those two don't feel they have to answer to anybody. That's probably why they're here tonight. Williams looked around the room. That man over there in the formal hunting outfit is Harry Cram. He's a legend. Williams was speaking of a patrician gentleman, about 70, who was wearing a scarlet tailcoat with gold embroidery over one pocket. "Harry Cram has never worked a day in his life," said Williams. "He's one of the first remittance men to come to the Low Country. His family sends his monthly checks from Philadelphia with the understanding he'll never go back there, and he leads a life of high style, traveling around the world, hunting, drinking, and playing polo. He's a wild man, completely charming. The woman standing next to him is his fourth wife, Lucy. They live out on Devil's Elbow, a huge wooded island off Bluffton, South Carolina. There's a John Singer Sargent portrait of Harry's grandfather in the dining room." In his formal hunting togs, Harry Cram looked a fit subject for a sergeant portrait himself. Harry used to amuse himself by flying over friends' houses in private planes and bombing them with bags of flour, aiming for the chimney, said Williams. One time he rode into the old DeSoto Hotel on horseback. He's a daredevil and a superb marksman. When he was living out at Foot Point Plantation, he'd invite people for Sunday lunch and tell them, "Now be sure to arrive by noon." And he meant it. At 11:45, he'd take a drink and his rifle and climb into a tree where he could watch his guests coming up the long driveway. At the stroke of noon, he'd take aim through the telescopic sights and shoot the hood ornaments off the cars of the latecomers just to let them know they were late. Williams caught Harry Cram's eye from across the room, and we started moving in his direction. "One last story before we say hello to Harry," Williams said. "About 5 years ago, two Paris Island Marines swam over to Harry's island in frogmen suits and broke into the house. They took Harry's 16-year-old son, Peter, at bayonet point down the hall to Harry's bedroom door. Peter called out, 'Dad, there's two men here with bayonets. They say they're going to kill me unless you give them some money.' Harry called back through the door, 'All right, just let me get the money.' Peter knew what to expect, so the moment Harry flung the door open, he ducked. Harry fired two shots with his .38 and hit both Marines between the eyes." At this point, Williams and I were standing in front of the Crams.
"I didn't hear you ask for a ginger ale, did I, Harry?"
Williams asked in mock alarm.
"I'm afraid you did," said Cram.
"Isn't it shameful? I'm on the wagon, believe it or not. It's been about a year now." Cram had bright, darting eyes and wispy hair that stood straight up on the top of his head like the crest of a snowy egret.
"Lucy brought me to the Veterans Hospital in Charleston, drunk as a fiddler's bitch. Apparently they asked me who the president was. They always ask drunks that. I hadn't the vaguest idea. So they put me in something called the tank. I was there a week, and I haven't wanted a drink since. I have no idea what they did to me. I've been meaning to ask."
Mrs. Cram nodded. "The time had definitely come," she said. "Harry wanted to play William Tell and shoot an apple off my head."
"I must say, though," said Harry, "I never shot badly during my drinking years. and I don't think I was ever sober from the age of 16. I've got on the wagon quite a few times in my life, but I always got off it in a hurry. This dinner jacket is proof of that. See this little hole? Cram pointed to a small hole just below his breast pocket. One time, years ago, I stopped drinking and locked all the liquor in the closet. The next day, I decided I'd been sober long enough, but I didn't have the patience to look for the key, so I just shot the lock off the door. The bullet went through every suit on the rack. Harry turned around. There was another bullet hole in the back. A couple standing next to the Crams joined the fun inspecting the bullet holes in Harry's jacket. Williams drifted toward the living room.
"And that's Harry Cram," he said.
"I imagine he's here tonight because it would never occur to him that he shouldn't be. Now, see that lady standing over by the window talking to the bald-headed man? She's Lila Mayhew. Her family's one of the oldest in Savannah. They've lived in two of Savannah's most important historic houses. She's a little dotty, though, so it's possible she doesn't even know that I've shot anybody." Williams left me and went back to the entrance hall, and I drew closer to Mrs. Mayhew. She was speaking to the bald man.
"Now, exactly where did Jim shoot the young man?"
Mrs. Mayhew asked, her voice sounding like that of a little lost girl.
"I think it was in the chest," the man said.
"No, I mean where in this house?"
"Oh, in the study, across the hall where you put your coat."
"And what did they do with the body?"
she asked.
"I suppose they buried it, wouldn't you?"
"That's not what I mean," said Mrs. Mayhew. "Did they cremate it first or bury it whole?"
"That I couldn't tell you."
"Because you know what happened to Grandmother, don't you?"
"I certainly do," said the man.
"Grandmother's body was sent to Jacksonville to be cremated."
"Yes, I remember that well," he said. "That's a famous story."
"And the crematorium sent her ashes back to us in an urn. We put the urn in the parlor until it could be interred at Bonaventure. But Father was a chemist, you know."
"And a very good one, too," said the man. "The very best."
"Father was feeling downcast and at loose ends. After supper, he took the urn downtown to his laboratory and performed tests on the ashes. That's when he found out they were not Grandmother's at all. The ashes were pure oak. They'd sent us the ashes from an oak tree. We never did find out what happened to Grandmother. When Father passed on, we took no chances. We buried him just as he was when he died, in his raincoat. That's why I wondered if they cremated the young man Jim shot, and if they did, whether they know for certain they got his ashes back."
Lila Mayhew trailed off into a sort of reverie, and the bald man peered out the living room window.
"My God," he said. "Here comes that Dawes woman. She's all in green from head to toe."
Serena Dawes was just then coming up the walk on the arm of Luther Driggers. She was wrapped in a green feather boa, and her fingernails, toenails, and eyeshadow were green to match. Williams greeted them at the front door.
"Our emerald bird has arrived at last," he said.
"I need a drink and a place to rest my ankles," Serena said, blowing a kiss and sweeping past him into the living room.
She settled herself in an armchair, arranging her ostrich feathers with one hand and scooping a martini from a passing tray with the other. Her eyes swept the room.
"Boy,"
she called to a short man with a camera,
"come over here and take a picture of a real lady."
Once the afterimage of flash bulbs had cleared from Serena's vision, her gaze came to rest on a pretty young blonde woman.
"I don't believe I've had the pleasure," Serena said sweetly. "I'm Serena Dawes."
"My name is Anna," the blonde woman said. "I'm visiting from Sweden."
"Isn't that nice?" said Serena. "And what brings you to Savannah?"
"Well, It's such a beautiful city. I love to come here to
look at it.
Really? Just to look? Is that all?
I love architecture, and you have such beautiful houses here.
But do you have friends in Savannah?
Serena persisted.
Oh, yes,
said Anna.
Do tell me who.
Colonel Atwood.
Well, said Serena, fluffing her feathers.
Why didn't you just say you've come to Savannah to fuck? We'd all have understood completely.
A dark-haired gentleman bowed and kissed Serena's hand. Serena, how lovely to see you out of bed.
Colonel Atwood, you're too kind. I'd get out of bed for you any time.
Colonel Jim Atwood was a man of varied interests. He was the first person in America to cultivate water chestnuts on any considerable scale, having planted 50 acres of them in a former rice paddy south of Savannah. But that was just a hobby. Atwood was primarily an entrepreneur and a trader, who dealt in everything from storage tanks to damaged merchandise. He had been known to produce his American Express card and buy, sight unseen, the contents of entire warehouses and ocean-going freighters. He had bought and sold 119 water-damaged sports cars in one deal and 400 tons of squashed dates in another. One of Colonel Atwood's many interests was the subject of his book, Edge Weapons of the Third Reich. At the time the book came out, he had cornered the market in Nazi daggers, swords, and bayonets. He had bought 60 German arms factories, together with their stocks of abandoned Nazi weapons. He also owned Hitler's personal silverware, heavy, oversized pieces with AH engraved in a slender sans-serif. Serena batted her eyes at Colonel Atwood.
Are you carrying any of your kraut daggers tonight, Colonel?
Nope. Only my trusty sidearm, said Atwood.
He took a small revolver out of his pocket and held it in his palm.
Know what this is?
Of course I do, said Serena. My late husband blew his brains out with one of those. Oh, said a bone-thin woman standing next to Serena. So did mine. I'll never forget it.
The woman was Alma Knox Carter, a convenience store heiress who lived across Monterey Square.
I was fixing myself a drink in the kitchen. Gunsmoke was on TV, and I heard a shot. Naturally, I didn't think anything about it. I thought it was part of the TV show, but then I walked into the foyer and saw Lyman sprawled out on the floor with a pistol in his hand.
Colonel Atwood's revolver caught the attention of Dr. Todd Fulton.
.22 Magnum, huh? Not bad. I carry this little number.
Dr. Fulton reached into his pocket and took out a black leather wallet. The wallet had a hole through the middle. The crescent curve of a trigger could be seen along one edge of the hole.
It's a .22 Derringer in disguise, he said. If a mugger holds me up and demands my money, all I have to do is pull out this wallet and payday.
My word, said Mrs. Carter. Dr. Fulton pocketed his wallet.
My wife carries a .38, he said.
So do I, said Anna brightly.
I'll tell you one thing, Mrs. Carter said. If I'd so much as touched that gun in Lyman's hand, they'd have charged me with murder as surely as I'm standing here.
Mrs. Carter was so frail, one might have doubted she had the strength to lift a gun.
Someday I will shoot a man, said Serena. God knows I've already tried.
She lifted a pearl-handled revolver out of her purse and held it daintily by its chrome-plated muzzle.
Just ask my former sweetheart, Shelby Gray. I wanted like hell to shoot him. I begged him to let me do it. I didn't want to kill him, of course. I only wanted to shoot him in the toe, just to give him something to remember me by. But the coward wouldn't hold still. I blew a hole in the air conditioner.
You shot him?
Mrs. Carter said, wide-eyed.
I missed.
How fortunate.
Serena sighed.
Not for dear Shelby. Now he has nothing of any permanence to remind him of my love.
Still, I am very much afraid I will have to shoot a man one day, and it won't be in the toe. My husband left me priceless jewels, as everybody knows, and certain individuals would love to get their hands on them. I live in fear of burglars day and night. That's why I always have this little beauty close at hand. When I'm at home, I keep it by my bed.
Serena glanced at Colonel Atwood.
And when I leave the house, I put it in my purse. But any time I feel the bastards are about to spring, I just stash it between my boobs.
Serena tucked the revolver into her bosom and lifted a fresh martini from a passing tray. Feeling in need of a drink myself at this point, I intercepted the waiter as he came in my direction. Two other guests, a man and a woman, stepped up and helped themselves, too.
It was a crime passionnel, the woman was saying, so I don't think it counts. You know, a lover's quarrel. These things happen. It isn't the same as murder.
My dear, said the man, it may have been a crime of passion, but I know three people who served on that grand jury. They've seen the evidence, and I gather it's going to be sticky for Jim. I turned my back and looked in the other direction, but at the same time, I moved closer to the couple in order to hear them better. The man lowered his voice. First of all, he said, I'm told the crime laboratory came up with some troubling results. There was no gunpowder residue on Danny Hansford's hands. That means he couldn't have fired the gun at Jim, as Jim claims he did.
Good Lord, the woman gasped.
The location of the bullet wounds also appears to be at odds with Jim's scenario of self-defense, the man said. One bullet entered the chest, which sounds all right, but another hit Hansford in the back. A third one hit him behind the ear. So the way it looks, Jim shot him once in the chest and then stepped around the desk and shot him twice more as he lay face down on the floor in a sort of coup de grace.
How dreadful, the woman said. You mean it wasn't self-defense?
I'm afraid it doesn't look that way. The fingerprint analysis is even more damaging. The gun found under Hansford's hand had no fingerprints on it at all, even though it had been fired. This means somebody wiped them off. So it begins to look as though Jim shot Danny and then got a second gun and fired a few shots from where Danny had been standing to make it look as if Hansford had fired at him. Then it seems he must have wiped his fingerprints off the gun and put it under Danny's hand.
I'm feeling faint, the woman said. What do you think will happen to Jim?
Just what I told him when I arrived here tonight. He'll get off.
But how is that possible? The woman asked.
A good lawyer can challenge the evidence, maybe even turn it around to the defendant's advantage. And Jim has good lawyers. That's why I think he'll get off. That, and because of his standing in the community. Having delivered his private assessment of the case, the man changed the subject, and I drifted into the hallway, where Williams and his mother were standing with a small circle of guests. Blanche Williams had driven in from Gordon, Georgia, where she had lived all her life. Now, in her late 70s, she was a tall woman, thin as a stork. Not a hair was out of place in the arrangement of tight white curls that covered her head like a snowy cap. She stood shyly, with her hands clasped in front of her. One of the other women was admiring her evening gown.
"Why, thank you," Mrs. Williams said politely. "James gave it to me. Whenever he has a big party, he likes to make sure I have a pretty new dress and that there's a flower waiting for me when I get to Savannah."
She glanced at her son, as if to reassure herself that she had said the right thing. "Mother is always the belle of the ball," Williams said heartily. Mrs. Williams took this as a sign of approval and was emboldened to continue.
"James has given me so many pieces of jewelry until finally I got to where I told him one day. I said, 'James, I don't know how I'll ever wear them all.' And he said, 'Well, Mother, I'll just have to give more parties so you can come to Savannah more often and wear all the things you've got.'
James is real good about taking me places, too. He's taken me to Europe 5 times, and, oh, 1 time he called and said, "Mother, we're going to leave in 3 days for London on the Concorde." And I said, "Now, James, don't tell me that. We're not going to fly anywhere on the Concorde." And he said, "Oh, yes, we are. I've already got the tickets." And I thought, "My Lord, what did they cost?" But then pretty quick I knew James was serious, and I had to stop fussing and get busy. I had to get ready in 3 days, and I did, and sure enough, we went to London on the Concorde.
Mrs. Williams spoke in a quiet rush of words, as if wanting to finish quickly and not trespass on the conversational terrain any longer than necessary. Her erect posture and the alert look in her eye suggested that despite her apologetic manner, she was a lady of considerable fiber and determination. In a few moments, Williams was drawn into a conversation with new arrivals, and Mrs. Williams and I found ourselves facing each other. I uttered a pleasantry about the festive party, and Mrs. Williams nodded in agreement.
"James has always had a crowd around him," she said, "even when he was little. One time he got him a little picture machine, the kind that flashes pictures on a wall, and he'd give little picture shows, and the other children would come over and have the best time, and he'd charge them a penny apiece. Of course, I had to have a little something for them to eat or drink, you know, just to munch. That was when he was 11 or 12. When he was 13, he used to ride around the countryside on his bicycle buying antiques to sell. That's how he started out. At first he went to the nigger houses, and he'd buy little oil lamps and things they didn't want. He'd pay a quarter for them, and then fix them up and sell them for 50 cents. Then he bought better things, like mirrors and furniture and whatnot, and he'd fix them up in his woodworking shop. He put a little ad in the paper, 'Antiques for sale,' and you'd be surprised. The ladies from Macon would come to Gordon and get him out of high school." The superintendent was so impressed. "They were high-class ladies, doctors' wives and so forth, and James would bring them to the house, and they'd buy things right out of his bedroom. He worked his way up, bit by bit, all by himself. It got to where a few years ago I thought, 'Isn't life grand? My children have turned out fine. My daughter teaches at the university, and James is doing so well in Savannah. My work is done. The Lord can take me now.' But he didn't. And when James got into this awful mess, I thought, 'This must be what God has been saving me for.'"
The din of the party surged in volume, but Mrs. Williams didn't raise her voice. She kept speaking in her quiet way, looking straight into my eyes. In fact, she seemed to be looking through me.
"James called me on a Saturday, right after lunch, I believe it was, and he told me, 'Mother, I've got bad news. I had to shoot Danny.' Well, I just froze. I said, 'Sugar, you come right straight home,' and he did. And when he got there, I didn't question him. I just let him talk when he felt like it, because he was so keyed up and hurt and everything else. And before long, people found out he was there. And I tell you, people started calling. Goodness, there were so many calls, I just put them on a slip."
Mrs. Williams paused as 2 guests stopped to say goodbye.
"Y'all be sure and come back again next year,"
she told them. Then she turned back to me.
"I never did trust that boy. He was kind of vague, the way he looked at you. I wouldn't tell James this, but to me, that Danny Hansford was just bad news. James brought him to the house one time. In a little bit, James went out in the back to wash his car, and I didn't see the boy. And I said, 'James, I don't see him.' And James said, 'Oh, that's all right, Mother. He told me he was just going to walk around out front.' Well, when it came time to eat, the boy was still not there. And James said, 'Mother, I'll tell you what. If Danny takes a notion to go somewhere, he won't tell anybody about it. He'll just go. He's done it before.' Well, right then, I understood what the boy had done. Don't ask me how I knew. Something just told me. I had an idea he was downtown hunting dope. Gordon's only a small town, but I figured he saw something down at the filling station on the way to the house, and he wanted to go back there and buy some dope. James found out the next day that the boy had hitchhiked all the way back to Savannah."
Mrs. Williams looked down briefly as she rearranged the wadded handkerchief she'd been clutching in her hands.
Now, I'll just be frank with you, she said. Sometimes James is too good to people. I don't know, maybe he got it from me. I can get feeling sorry for people too quick, and that's not good, because a lot of people know how to play you and get your sympathy. I know some people do James that way, and he'll get to where he feels sorry for them. He'll try to help him like he tried to help that boy. There were times I felt like maybe I should talk to James, but being a mother, I was afraid I might be interfering. You don't want to overstep the line. So I never did talk to him like I wish I had. James'd help anybody, and that's the reason I just hate to see him in this mess. Why, when James sold Cabbage Island and made a bunch of money, the first thing he did was he fixed up my house, and then he gave my church a check for $10,000 to buy an electric organ. I just don't know. Maybe this mess is going to be a lesson. I believe it's going to make James realize that he's got to think of himself sometimes.
Mrs. Williams smiled as her son reappeared at her side.
Well, I'll hush now, she said.
What have you two been talking about? He asked.
I was saying how everything is going to work out just fine, James.
Mrs. Williams's answer was drowned out by the convivial hubbub around her.
I'm sorry, Mother, I didn't hear.
Mrs. Williams took a deep breath, and for the first time all evening she raised her voice a little.
I said, everything is going to work out just fine.
Of course it is, Mother, he said. It always has. And it always will.
Chapter 15 Civic Duty.
Hell, I'd have shot Danny Hansford, too, said Dr. James C. Metz, the coroner of Chatham County. This guy was just a badass. He scared Williams to death. You know, hell, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and here he is having a temper fit because Williams won't play an Atari game.
Dr. Metz, a generally soft-spoken man, had spent several hours investigating the scene at Mercer House the night of the shooting. It was he who had signed the death certificate and ordered the autopsy. A week before Jim Williams's trial was to begin, one of Williams's lawyers, John Wright Jones, paid a call on Dr. Metz in his office to discuss the case. John Wright Jones was one of Savannah's better-known criminal lawyers. A burly bear of a man, he was assisting in Williams's defense. He had seen the autopsy report and the police photographs taken in Mercer House after the shooting. He was concerned about the bullet hole in Danny Hansford's back and the one behind his ear. He asked Dr. Metz if it was possible to reconstruct the shooting in such a way that Danny Hansford was not lying face down when those two shots hit him.
Yes, said Dr. Metz, you could do that. The first shot hit him in the front left side of the chest. When you get shot in the chest, it's like a punch. You rotate, you spin around. So the next shot hits you in the right side of the back, and you keep rotating, and the next one hits you behind the ear. It's possible, if the ballistics work out, that Danny Hansford was not shot lying down. He could have been standing up.
That's what I was hoping, said Jones.
So the bottom line is that you don't really know whether or not he was shot when he was lying on the floor, do you?
That's correct.
All right, and if you are called to testify, that's what you're going to say?
Yes, said Dr. Metz. But, John, you've got another problem. The hand lying on top of the gun has blood all over it, and there's no blood on the gun itself. Now, there are only two places where blood was flowing from Danny Hansford, his head and his chest. The boy, when he fell, must have fallen on his right hand. And I guess maybe for artistic license, Williams must have moved his hand out and put it over the gun where, you know, it looked better.
You sure about that?
Positive. You see, the blood on Hansford's hand is smeared, like somebody dragged it out from under the body. If I were you, I'd say Williams panicked and checked Danny Hansford's pulse, reached in there and pulled his arm out and checked his pulse, and then put it on the gun so it would look better or something.
Dr. Metz's suggestion was not an acceptable option. Jim Williams had already put his version of the story on record with his interview in the Georgia Gazette. In the interview, Williams had made no mention of ever touching the body.
"Damn if you don't brighten up my day," said Jones.
"Then there's one other thing," said Dr. Metz. "Something else that shows Mr. Williams rearranged the scene. He moved the furniture to make things look a little bit better, I guess, but he got a little careless doing it."
"In what way?"
"He picked up a chair and put it down on top of the guy's britches leg." Dr. Metz chuckled.
"Ooh, I bet you all got pictures of that, ain't you?"
"Color prints," said the coroner.
"It shows the pants leg underneath the chair?"
"Uh-huh."
"Well, that sure is nice."
Jones shook his head ruefully.
"What else you got?"
"I tell you what," said Dr. Metz. "I believe I know when that bastard got shot."
"When was that?"
asked Jones. "When he stubbed out his cigarette."
"His what?"
"I found a cigarette butt that had been stubbed out into the leather desktop. It was still sitting on its end. I think when the guy did that, Mr. Williams got pissed off and shot him."
"Like I said, Doc, you really brighten up my day," said Jones.
"Quite frankly, though, my sympathies lie with Mr. Williams," said Dr. Metz. "It did occur around 3 in the morning. Mr. Williams presumably had to get up and work, and this kid was being an obnoxious bastard, wanting to play games and bust up the furniture."
"Any other kind words of encouragement?" Jones asked.
"Not that I can think of, John," he said. "You've got your work cut out for you, though. I would think your jury selection is going to be key. You have a problem there in that it was obviously a homosexual-type situation. You'll have to play it so the jury is sympathetic to Mr. Williams and don't think too bad of him for shooting this guy." Jones picked up his briefcase.
"Well, as we all know, Doc, juries in Savannah don't seem to mind seeing homosexuals get killed. I mean, you can stomp a homosexual to death in our community, and that doesn't seem to make a difference."
"No, I know," said Dr. Metz. He walked Jones to the door of his office. "Well, John, all I can say is Mr. Williams probably did his civic duty shooting this son of a bitch." John Wright Jones's remark about stomping homosexuals to death was a reference to a murder case that had come to trial only a few months earlier and deeply shocked Savannah. The murder victim in that case had been a 33-year-old man from Columbus, Georgia, who had come to Savannah to judge a beauty pageant. Married and with 2 children, he was stomped to death in a darkened parking garage by 4 U.S. Army Rangers. Rangers were reputed to be the toughest men in the Army. There was a squadron of them out at Hunter Army Airfield on the south side. They were trained to endure harsh punishment and to dish it out as well. Early on the evening of the stomping, a witness saw the 4 Rangers strolling on Bay Street, bending parking meters to the ground with their bare hands. Later, the 4 went into Missy's Adult Boutique, a pornographic bookshop off Johnson Square, where they encountered the beauty pageant judge. The man made a sexual advance. They enticed him into a parking garage and beat and kicked him so brutally that an expert in trauma injury testified that when the victim arrived at the hospital, he was probably the most mutilated person I have ever seen still alive. He had suffered multiple fractures of the skull, cheeks, jawbone, and eye sockets. The expert said it had taken 2 people to pry his eyes open. He was almost unrecognizable as a human being. At the trial, the attorney for the Rangers asked the jury to place responsibility where it lies. The defendants, he said, were young, foolish, clean-cut, and honest. They had been the victims of a homosexual advance. The jurors were sympathetic to the Rangers and rejected the charge of murder. Still, each man had admitted kicking the victim, so the jurors felt compelled to declare them guilty of something. They chose the lightest possible count, simple battery. Simple battery is a misdemeanor. It can mean that one person merely touched another. The sentence was 1 year in jail, with the possibility of parole in 6 months. The Ranger verdict provoked a bitter public outcry. Letters to the newspaper condemned the jury for its callousness and for sullying the name of justice in Savannah. One of the nurses who had treated the victim wrote, "If this is a misdemeanor, may I never see the victim of a felony." The trial had been the courtroom debut of Chatham County's new district attorney, 37-year-old Spencer Lawton, Jr. The verdict had been a crushing defeat, and it left observers wondering whether Lawton was capable of discharging the responsibilities of his new office. The Lawtons were a distinguished old Savannah family. Spencer Lawton's great-great-grandfather, General Alexander R. Lawton, had been in charge of defending Savannah during the early part of the Civil War, and later became Quartermaster General of the Confederate Army. After the war, General Lawton was one of the 10 men who founded the American Bar Association. He served as its president in 1882. Later, Grover Cleveland appointed him ambassador to Austria. The Lawton family plot at Bonaventure Cemetery was one of the largest. A white marble figure of Christ stood by a towering Gothic arch on a bluff by the river. Another of Lawton's forebears, Spencer Schotter, amassed a fortune in the naval stores business at the turn of the century and built one of the most grandiose estates in the South on the grounds of Greenwich Plantation, immediately adjacent to Bonaventure Cemetery. Schotter hired the renowned architectural firm of Carrere and Hastings, designers of the New York Public Library building on Fifth Avenue, to build the house. It had 40 rooms and a double colonnade of gleaming white marble columns that wrapped around all four sides. There were 12 master bedrooms, 10 baths, a ballroom decorated in gold leaf, a dairy farm, a covered swimming pool, and magnificently landscaped grounds. Palm trees were imported from the Holy Land, a weeping willow from Napoleon's tomb on St. Helena, and statues from the ruins of Pompeii. The estate was the setting for exquisite balls and yachting parties. Movie scenes, starring Mary Pickford and Francis X. Bushman, were filmed there. By the time Spencer Lawton came along, however, the grandeur of the Lawton family had all but vanished. The Schotter mansion had been destroyed by fire in the 1920s, and the grounds became an extension of Bonaventure Cemetery, known as Greenwich Cemetery. The prestigious law firm of Lawton and Cunningham had been absorbed by another law firm. The imposing Lawton Memorial Hall on Bull Street had been converted to a Greek Orthodox church. Spencer Lawton was a soft-spoken, mild-mannered man with gentle blue-gray eyes and dark hair combed in a pompadour. Chubby cheeks and a ribbon-bow mouth gave him a cherubic look. He had been, by his own admission, an indifferent student at the University of Georgia Law School. Afterward, he returned to Savannah to practice law. He did largely pro bono work. A woman who encountered him when he was a hearing officer for the Savannah Housing Authority remembered him as being highly principled. "He was a decent man," she said. "He more than did his job. He showed concern and compassion for the poor. But he was a little timid, as I recall." For the past 30 years, the Chatham County Prosecutor's Office had been the private domain of Joe Ryan. Ryan's son, Andrew Bubsy Ryan, had succeeded his father and had served 1 term when Spencer Lawton decided to run against him. Bubsy Ryan was a good old boy. He liked to go fishing, hunting, and drinking. He had a full head of tousled brown hair, long reddish sideburns, and bags under his eyes that made him look permanently hungover. He got along well with the police. He was good at horse trading and had a folksy, drawling courtroom manner. Bubsy argued every major murder case himself, but it was no secret that his management of the prosecutor's office was casual at best, just as it had been under his father. A backlog of over 1,000 untried cases stretched back 25 years. Bubsy enjoyed being D.A., but he admitted it did have its drawbacks.
"You're limited in some ways," he said. "You can't go out drinking with your wife, 'cause you'll read about it in the paper the next day."
The Ryans were not accustomed to having opposition at election time. But when Bubsy came up for re-election, one of his assistant DAs announced he would challenge him in the Democratic primary. The two began sniping at each other almost immediately, and on the last day of filing, Spencer Lawton saw an opportunity for himself and made it a three-way race.
"I ran for a lark," Lawton said later.
While the other two tore into each other, Lawton took the high road and spoke about case management and other sensible-sounding things. He tiptoed through the wreckage of Bubsy and the other man. When Bubsy and Lawton found themselves in a runoff, Bubsy took aim at Lawton. He hooted that Lawton had been a failure as a lawyer, that he had never tried a felony case, never had appellate experience, never argued a case before the Georgia Supreme Court, and that as a direct result of his laziness and incompetence, he had exposed a law firm he had worked for to a malpractice suit. 2 days before the election, Bubsy went one step further. He took out a half-page ad in the Savannah Morning News and quoted from a statement made in divorce proceedings by Lawton's former wife. Mrs. Lawton said that Spencer had told her many times that he would be happier staying at home and keeping the house and reading than he would be working. The underlying message in the ad was that Spencer Lawton was not man enough for the job. Bubsy's crowd referred to Lawton as the Pillsbury Doughboy. But then, on the night of the primary, Bubsy Ryan watched in disbelief as the returns from the black precincts went against him and gave the nomination to Lawton. Lawton went on to defeat the Republican candidate in the general election. Doubts about Lawton's ability grew after he took office. Disgruntled staff members, holdovers from Bubsy Ryan's era, passed the word that Lawton didn't know the law.
"He's asking for memos on things he should know," one assistant DA complained, "like extradition. He wanted a memo on insanity defense, too, which you could write a book about."
Then came the stunning defeat in the Rangers case. As it happened, the Ranger verdict was handed down a few days after Jim Williams shot Danny Hansford. Lawton drew a bead on the Williams case. It would be a means of redeeming himself if he won, but it would be a difficult fight. To handle his defense, Jim Williams retained Bobby Lee Cook of Somerville, Georgia. Cook was a famous character in criminal courts throughout the South. His specialty was murder. Over a span of 30 years, Cook had defended 250 people accused of murder and got 90% of them off, sometimes against substantial odds. Cook would take the untouchable cases, cases nobody thought could be won, and he'd win them. He was famous for his lacerating cross-examinations. "I've seen him take a fellow before lunch," said a federal judge. "Examine him a while, comment at lunchtime that he was playing his witness like a bass, and then come back after lunch and finish destroying the man." In an article extolling his technique and his daring, People magazine had once declared that if the devil ever needed a defense, Bobby Lee Cook would take the case. Being from the mountains of North Georgia, Cook knew that a Savannah jury would perceive him as a slick, out-of-town lawyer. Therefore, he wanted a local lawyer to assist him, and in filling that position, he selected the attorney most likely to unnerve Spencer Lawton, the lawyer who had just beaten him so badly in the Rangers case, John Wright Jones. Chapter 16. Trial. The Chatham County Courthouse was one of a half-dozen modern buildings in downtown Savannah. It was made of precast concrete. Flat, blockish, and bland, It sat at the western edge of the historic district. A companion building stood next to it and was linked to it by an underground tunnel. This other building, also made of concrete, was a vault-like cube with vertical slits for windows. The Chatham County Jail. The benches at the rear of Judge George Oliver's courtroom were filled to capacity on the first